big bears right down the backyard.
And we have squirrels. Our dogs think they are the protector of us from the squirrels.
Yeah.
Okay, let's start back up. We'll try to end right about 9, so we've got just about 28 minutes left. What I want to look at next, and I don't want to get into everything in Isaiah right now because of how much it's going to take us to do so, but if you're looking at the online list of material, if you look at the handout number 3, it's called Trusting the Text. It's a PDF. And so, yeah, I'm showing it here on the screen. I want to do this rather quickly in the 20-plus minutes we have to do so. One of the things, and this is one of the reasons I don't like to recommend certain texts for studies of some Old Testament books, is because of the view that some people take of biblical inspiration and the integrity of the text. So if you do any kind of studying, and you pick up, you know, many scholastic commentaries on the book of Isaiah, you will see them referring to 1st, 2nd, and 3rd Isaiah, only they will call it Deutero or Trito Isaiah. And so some people are not quite sure that Isaiah wrote all of the text, and they question the integrity and the inspiration of the text. So I don't recommend any kind of commentaries that are going to be involved in that kind of hypocritical stuff. But I do want to do some things that are going to make us appreciate what we're studying. And so this will be lead-in to what we're going to do when we get together next time. And so I presented this material, you can see, several years ago at the Palm Beach Lakes Church in South Florida several years ago. And I had the privilege of speaking 5 times Friday through Sunday. And one of the things I dealt with was the issue of canonicity. What does that mean? Well, I'm going to explain that in just a minute. First, canon is the name of a camera company. I got that. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about something different, and that's going to be explained. So we're going to ask some questions. Which books belong in the Bible? And the reason why I'm saying this is because one of the marks of canonicity is the issue of the role Old Testament prophets play. And the reason why I'm bringing that out is it's going to undergird and provide a foundation for the reliability of what we're studying when we're studying the book of Isaiah. And so this is not a class in Old Testament criticism. This is not a class in Christian evidence. This is not a class in biblical inspiration. And this is not technically a class in how to interpret the Bible, though we will do that and incorporate it as we're going through the class. So I want to ask some questions about why we have what we have in the Bible. So here are the questions: what is canon, who determines canon, what determines canon, and how does it impact us today? And it impacts us today, obviously, by means of the scriptures that we have. So the question, canon, what is it? The word means a general rule of law. It initially was a pattern or a system of measurement. We often refer to a cubit as a measurement. And a cubit was roughly the length from one's elbow to the end of their fingertips. And so it could vary, but it was roughly that length, the stadia or the furlongs that you see mentioned in the context of the book of Revelation. And so it was an instrument of measure. And it was a measurement of law, rules, principles, or criteria by which something is judged. So you have gold standards, and you have silver standards, you have atomic clocks. All of those are canons in the sense that they are a measurement of some particular physical thing or something that's legal, moral, spiritual, and so forth. So in the context of referring to scriptures, it refers to a preserved collection of God's words accepted as genuine. And I'm going to get off subject just for a half a second because we're going to get into the New Testament in just a minute. If you ever have an opportunity to pick up Everett Ferguson's book, Everett Ferguson is a retired teacher from Abilene Christian. He's probably nearly 90, if not 90 now. But he wrote a book called The Rule of Faith. And The Rule of Faith is a book that demonstrates that the principles of canonicity existed long before anybody ever authoritatively determined what was in the New Testament. And his point was, people knew what was New Testament doctrine before the New Testament was finalized. And so that's based upon the principle of canon. So it's a preserved collection of God's Word accepted as genuine, a standardized collection. And that refers to the 39 books we have in the Old and the 27 books we have in the New Testament. And very quickly, the way that they were numbered in the Old Testament differs. And so sometimes Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles were three books, not six. Two books of Samuel, two books of Kings, two books of Chronicles. And some other books were collectively brought together. For example, all the minor prophets. So in the Old Testament canonical books are most importantly those connected with divine redemption. Now notice this. The model of canonicity, determining canonicity, has to do with whether or not a book possessed some key traits. And one of them was, is it redemptive oriented? So we've already said that Isaiah deals with questions of political issues. It deals with issues of land. It deals with armies. It deals with economics. It deals with the nations round about it. It deals with the sovereignty of God. It deals, more importantly, with the notion of whether or not the nation of Israel is being obedient to God's law, to God's covenant. And so Isaiah is definitely a redemptive-oriented book. You might say, well, it doesn't have the plan of salvation in it. Well, what we think about plan of salvation is often limited from the standpoint of the scope of the Bible as a whole. The whole book, the whole Bible is a plan of salvation. It's all redemptive. It's all salvation connected. And I'm not trying to dismiss anything that we would call the plan of salvation today. My point is, all of it's necessary. But it also reveals divine acts on behalf of God's people. What does that mean? Well, it means it demonstrates how God's providentially acting for His people to accomplish His will to save all people. So God's working through His people, the nation of Israel, by means of which all people are going to be saved. So the Messiah comes through Israel for everyone. And so Israel becomes the conduit. So it reveals divine acts on behalf of God's people. It reveals divine commands given to God's people. And some of those commands have application to nations around them. It also reveals divine prophecies and promises to God's people, going all the way back to Genesis. And it also records the failures or successes of God's people based on whether or not they're doing what God wants them to do. So the independent standard by which they're all being measured is the Old Testament law of Moses. So this is why at the very beginning I referred to prophets as covenant enforcers. What are they enforcing? The law of Moses is the covenant that God gave to them. And so all of the prophets are dealing with those issues as it relates to God's people. So these are some of the hallmarks, some of the characteristics by which we identify Old Testament text. So who determines canon? Well, if you read all of these passages, and I'm not going to look at all of them, they're on the slides that are already up at the website. God's the one who initiated the law of Moses. God said, write these things down, Moses. And so you'll see literal passages where God told Moses to write these things down, some of which are mentioned. The next line, God told Moses to write. So God started the law. These are the things I'm revealing to you and through you for the nation. You write them down. And then indeed, Moses wrote. But Moses isn't the only one that wrote. Incidentally, one of the conditions that's mentioned when kings are going to come about in the latter part of the book of Deuteronomy, it says when somebody becomes a king, one of the things that he was required to do was write out the law in his own hand. So imagine you were tasked with writing out the law in your own hand, and most scholars assume that it was probably the entirety of the book of Deuteronomy. If you had to write out the entire book of Deuteronomy by hand, no word processors, no keyboards, no pen and paper, and like we think about, using what they would have used in those days, stylus and papyrus or something else like that, that would have been quite a task. And so they were commissioned to write. So Moses wrote, Joshua wrote, priests wrote, recorded things that God wanted recorded. Samuel wrote, Nathan wrote, Jeremiah wrote, and others are described as writing. So my point is, there was a huge deal upon inscribing these things on something that were going to last beyond the moment in which they were initially given. All right? So God didn't just give Moses 10 commandments and said, I hope you remember these, go on your way. But God inscribed them on tablets of stone. And when they were first broken, another set was given. And then all of these things were codified. They were written down. There were regulations that were recorded for the benefit of the nation of Israel. And so that would have included all the priestly requirements, everything concerning all the sacrifices and the book of Leviticus, and all of the other civic requirements. It would have included all the familial requirements, all the business-related things, how to do anything and everything. That was all recorded in the biblical text. And so all of these things become part of what we refer to as the standard or the canon. So what determines Old Testament canon? Notice one of the first things that's in almost every list, prophetic connection. All right, prophetic connection. So I want to be careful here. I don't make light or make fun of people who believe things that I don't think are biblical, but I will often use them as an illustration to make a point. You will often see, as you go through lots of different places in this country and perhaps in other countries as well, people making a claim to apostolic connection. What's interesting is that's one of the first hallmarks of canonicity for the New Testament. Does it have apostolic connection? Not because you can draw a line historically or genealogically or bloodline, but doctrinally, is there apostolic connection? And so the church began to be proclaimed, the message of the church was proclaimed by means of Peter standing up the rest of the 11 on the day of Pentecost. Incidentally, the apostles are referenced four times in that chapter. He stood up with the apostles. They asked men and brethren, what shall we do? And they all continued the apostles' doctrine. And there's one other reference before that in Acts chapter 2. So it wasn't just Peter that was speaking that day. You don't have everything that Peter recorded, but others no doubt spoke as well. But there's an apostolic connection. Here in the Old Testament, it's prophetic connection. Is there written documentation of divine communication? That was originated by God. And Isaiah is a prophet commissioned by God. So when we're reading through the 66 chapters that are Isaiah, we're not just reading something that Isaiah threw together. This was commissioned by God. And so many of the Old Testament prophets will begin, thus says the Lord by means of the prophet, and then it will list the prophet's name. And so if you start going from Isaiah through the end of Malachi, you'll see many of them begin the exact same way. The only difference is that prophet's name as opposed to another one. So the word of the Lord that came to Isaiah is the one we're talking about, the son of Amoz. So marks of authenticity, and you'll find these to greater or lesser degrees in all of the texts that we're going to be surveying as we read through the Old Testament. Historically accurate, geographically accurate, chronologically accurate, morally consistent. Let me just mention the chronology. Remember, prophets jump back and forth in time. All right. How many times have you been watching a television show or a feature film or whatever it might be, you're watching on Amazon Prime or Netflix or whatever, and all of a sudden there's a break in the story, and when it starts back, it'll say 6 years earlier. Then, what's going on here? You know, you're confusing me. And so sometimes they'll tell the backstory. And so we discovered a television series that came out 8 or 9, 10 years ago, never heard of it before, and we got into it, and one of the things that's interesting is each new episode does backstory about how this whole thing got started. Well, any good literature does that. The Bible does the same thing. So occasionally, as you're reading through the New Testament, it's almost, and I want to be careful, it's almost like the narrator in Winnie the Pooh starts to speak. And they say, who was that? And they go, that's the narrator. Well, what's the narrator doing? The narrator is telling you something that you should know in order to make sense of the story. So as you're reading through the book of John, John will pause and he'll step outside of what's going on in the immediate event and say, we didn't know this when it first happened, but now we do. Well, Isaiah does that. All the prophets do that. They'll stand out of the story. So when we think about chronology, we often think about starts at point, you know, zero, and it goes through 10 steps, and it's straight linear all the time. But sometimes it'll stop and it'll backtrack and say, hey, between 1 and 2 back here, you need to know this happened. All right? So prophets do what almost every literature does. Good literature is it goes back and forth in time as it's telling the narrative. All right? Incidentally, if I use the word story, some people get very excited if you use the word story with reference to anything in the Bible because they say, well, the word story means it's not true. That's not the way it's used in the Bible. All right, and so when I use the word story, I don't mean anything negative about it at all. I'm simply referring to what I believe to be historical reality of real people, places, and events. So I will call it the text, the biblical narrative, or the story. The storyline is the plot line that God's revealing. And I mean nothing negative by that. So I only bring that up because I know some people say, I don't like to call anything in the Bible a story. It belittles it. That's not what the Bible itself does.
I just do that with kids.
Oh, I understand that. Yeah, and I'm glad you said it. Some people equate the word story with fiction.
And we talk about this was a real story and it was nonfiction.
Got that.
Because they need that.
No, I understand that. So there's accuracy in all these levels, historical, geographic, chronological. I stopped there to make sure we understand that flow is not always linear and sometimes it'll backtrack. Moral consistency. The prophecy is primarily getting people back on track religiously from the standpoint of whether or not they're obedient to law. So there's a huge dose of morality brought out. For example, if you're studying the prophet Amos, prophet to the northern kingdom, Amos is all over the top of dealing what people do with their money, because what they do with their money was a determinant of whether or not they were moral. You might say, well, what's that about? Well, Amos says, you live in the finest of houses. You have ivory couches, and you have all the chalices and all your silverware, whatever, made of the most expensive metals. And it says you've taken advantage of so many people to get there. And so, not sure why it's doing that. It's making a noise once in a while. I guess I haven't muted everybody. But anyway, the point is, you know, their accuracy about all of these things. Right. So if you're listening, make sure you mute all your microphones if you would do that. Alright, so there's soteriological accuracy, which means that there's a principle of redemption and salvation that's taught consistently. And then there's consistent theological principles with reference to who God is and who his people are. So all of these things determine the legitimacy of canon. Same thing about canon going forward. The material that's in some translations, and I say some translations, in between the Old Testament and the New Testament is often referred to as apocrypha or pseudepigrapha. The word pseudepigrapha means pseudo, meaning false, epigrapha meaning writing, and they're often referred to as false or less than worthy writings. And I don't want to get into all of the nuances of that. I'm not saying they don't have historical value, but the point is there's no authority on par with what we see for the Old Testament canon. Inconsistent compared to that, not regarded as God's words by the Jews. Incidentally, if you read the writings of Josephus, he pretty much enunciates all the texts of the Old Testament that were respected during the time of Jesus that we would consider to be authoritative today. So in the New Testament, Old Testament is referred to as 295 times. No extra biblical books are ever cited as authoritative. Let me just say, if you read through the New Testament, Paul often cited philosophers and poets, but he never called them prophets. He never called them God's spokesman. So what books belong there? So this is written in the writings of the Maccabees, and there are four books of Maccabees generally afforded to be part of that writing block between the Testaments, pseudepigrapha, apocrypha, and the first two are more historical than the others. And so in this text, even the book of Maccabees refers to tearing down the altar, storing the stones in a convenient place on the temple hill, until there should come a prophet to tell them what to do with them. So they recognize prophets have to speak about these things. And then later in the book of Maccabees, 1 Maccabees, it says, such as has not been since the time that the prophets ceased to appear among them. And so in the context, in the New Testament, it talks about the completion of prophecy with reference to the New Testament. But the same thing occurs in the context of the Old Testament. There's a completion of prophecy mentioned. So what determines canon? All right, I mentioned Josephus before. From Artaxerxes, and we're not going to get into who he was historically speaking, to our own times, a complete history has been written, but hasn't been deemed worthy of equal credit with the earlier records because the failure of the exact succession of, note, the prophets. Prophetic succession had a lot to do with whether or not an Old Testament text was regarded as included in the canon. After the latter prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi had died, the Holy Spirit departed from Israel, but they still availed themselves, and that's referring to the scriptures. And this is from the Talmud, the oral tradition that was later written and encoded. And his point was, it was generally understood that prophecy ended at the end of these prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. So I'm not going to go too much into this because it's not particularly germane to what we're doing. Same thing about the New Testament. Whose project was the New Testament? What was a God-oriented thing? Matthew didn't say, hey, I think I'll start the New Testament. Mark didn't say, hey, I'll contribute to it. No, it was a God-oriented thing. So Jesus promised the Spirit he's going to teach all things beyond the time he was going to be there. And so we see apostolic authority on par with prophetic authority. That's emphasized in the New Testament. So apostolic connection in the New Testament is paralleled in part with prophetic authority. In 2 Peter 3:2, the apostles and the prophets are put on par with each other. Acts 5:1 equates lying to an apostle as lying to the Spirit of God. That's talking about Ananias and Sapphira. 1 Corinthians 2 reveals apostolic inspiration revelation is originating with God, ending with, we have the mind of Christ in verse 16. Paul's writing equals the commandments of the Lord. Why is that? Because it all originated with him. Same sort of thing that determined Old Testament canon affects New Testament canon. There's got to be a God connection through inspired people. Prophets, apostles, or others upon whom God, through whom God revealed the word. So I'm not going to look at all these passages. Same sort of thing about the Old Testament applies to New Testament, only as apostolic as opposed to prophetic. Documentation and divine communication, marks of authenticity are close to what we saw before. So I'm not going to go through all of these things. They are on the chart that's on the handout number 3 called Trusting the Text. So I want to go back very quickly because we're going to get more into the text, very much so, next time. If you look at handout number 4 and handout number 4A and handout number 4B, those are all provided by World Video Bible School. And you will see that they are either course notes for Isaiah, and this is the material that they have provided. We have been allowed to use those things. They are not to be resold or just given away, but I'm allowed to use them in teaching others. But we will occasionally refer to those. My point is you're going to have lots of notes about Isaiah. Underneath that, that's number 4. Number 4A is the syllabus they use. We're not using that, but you're welcome to look at that as to how they conduct the class when they do their stuff online. 4B is a list of all the videos that are already online for Isaiah, and I've also included Jeremiah. And so if you want to get more background material than what we're presenting here, there are 24 different, roughly 35-minute videos on the book of Isaiah. And so that's like 12 hours of nonstop viewing on the book of Isaiah. And because I've taught another class on Lamentations in conjunction with this, I've included those as well. So all those are freely available at the website that I maintain, thebible.net, which needs a complete overhaul. And then the last thing that I want to mention today, well, next to the last thing, we've got just a couple of minutes left. I mentioned at the beginning of the class that years and years and years ago, almost 40 years ago, I read through and wrote commentary, brief commentary on every chapter of the Bible. And you can see that this starts Isaiah, this starts on page 162. And I think it is roughly 20 pages long if you get to the end of that. And so it's not all loading at the same time because it's a large PDF. But we're going to use that as a starting point as we move our way through the book of Isaiah. I will refer to this. I'm not going to read it verbatim, but I will allude to that. And so that's there for you to use as a tool as well, and we'll provide extra material. And the last thing I want to mention in class today, we've got just about 4 or 5 minutes before we end. This is a capture from an old version of a Greek New Testament. And what it is, it's an index of all the quotations that are from the Old Testament in the New Testament. And so it's Old Testament order specific. It starts with the book of Genesis, goes through the book of Exodus and so forth. So if you scroll down through this, you'll get to, on the second or third page, you see Psalms on page 898, and look at all the columns that are there. But then you'll see Isaiah. So on page 899, and the left-hand column, innermost column, starts Isaiah. And all of this starting with chapter 1 and going through chapter 66. On the right-hand side, it'll say, here's where that passage in Isaiah is found in the New Testament. And so the point is, Isaiah is cited many, many times, either expressly saying, Isaiah said this, or well did Isaiah said, or it will just cite Isaiah and never call the name. All right. Sometimes things are so well known to New Testament writers and Christians in the New Testament age, you didn't have to say who said it. Everybody knows, well, Isaiah said that or Jeremiah said that. But sometimes we'll explicitly mention that. And so my point is Isaiah is cited many times, more so than any of the books of prophecy. So if you look at Psalms and you see how much is listed there, middle of 898, bottom half of the column, full column, and a good part of the column after that. So about 2 full columns. Isaiah is a little bit less than that. So it's a little bit less frequently cited than the book of Psalms, but not much. Notice Jeremiah. There's not a lot in Jeremiah that's cited in the New Testament. Ezekiel, not much. Daniel, a few more. Hosea, a few more, especially God desires mercy, not sacrifice. That comes from Hosea. Joel, Amos, Jonah. Notice, if you look at Isaiah, Isaiah collectively is almost cited more than every other Old Testament prophet put together. What's the point? Isaiah is a big deal in the New Testament. And so as we're studying the Old Testament book of Isaiah, we are unwittingly or wittingly studying a huge part of what's brought out in the New Testament because of how frequently Isaiah is cited in the New Testament. So that makes it a big deal. All right, so next week we will actually get into the text. I'll give some key ideas, and I will send messages to everybody with the audio, video, and other handouts beforehand. I apologize for not getting everything perfect tonight. I like to blame it on Lyle, but it's not Lyle's fault. It's my fault. I'll become more adept at using Zoom, and I've discovered already that we can do screen sharing, so you'll actually see everything that I have on the screen when you're just looking at me if you're out there in the internet world. But any questions or comments that anybody has in the class, and I'm going to check the chat real fast to see if anybody has any questions or comments. All right, if you need to reach me when class is done, just send a message to Jody, J-O-D-Y, at thebible.net, and we will take up next time. I'll try to be here earlier to get everything set up and send you an email message in advance for the link. All right, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it. Look forward.
What was that, Jody?
Just Jody, J-O-D-Y, at thebible, T-H-E-B-I-B-L-E.net. And I will send emails with all that information in it to everybody either later tonight or tomorrow morning.
Okay.
All right? Crystal, glad you're here.
Yes, sir.
I know you had to drive all the way to get here, but I'm glad you're here.
Yes.
What's that?
Yes, to drive back.
Well, listen, driving back is going to be easier than driving here.
Yeah, honestly, yes, because of the traffic that time of day, and then it's sending me up Highway 124. Very congested area at that time of day. So
I don't know, 85 is the worst.
There's not so many red lights, and the speed limit's not, goes and goes from 45, 55, 35. So
two ways are almost equidistant for me, either coming down 400 and then across 20 or going over to Gainesville and getting on 985.
Right.
985 has now 70 mile per hour speed limit on it.
Yep.
I just saw they changed that in several places around the state. And so
in
one of two ways I'm going to hit traffic. I hit traffic going to Gainesville, and when I get on 985, it speeds up. Other way, I've got 65 coming down 400, and then I slow down when I get to coming to come across. So I'm going to hit traffic one way coming here. On the way back, there's nobody out.
That's the bad part about 20 going from Gwinnett to Forsyth. It's a federal bridge over the Chattahoochee, and it's a state road. So coming expanded wide, and Gwinnett has to come up because they're waiting for the federal to still move the bridge more north towards the lake. And then 20 and Gwinnett will flow to the bridge. And 4 years ago,